Good morning. At the 9:15 service, we talked a little bit about this poem, and the conversation included the two words that I use in the title of my sermon, namely coping with ambiguity. And then one person made a remark about this poem, which I thought summarized my entire sermon, whereupon somebody suggested that we go and drink coffee. Luckily, we didn't have this conversation right now, so I get to say my sermon after all. Coping with ambiguity. In May of 1959, over half a century ago, Charles Percy Snow gave a lecture at Cambridge University with the intriguing title, The Two Cultures. The lecture was published and quickly became an international sensation. Professor Snow was elevated to Baron Snow, and his phrase, two cultures, entered the English language. It refers to the division of the academic world into the humanities and the sciences. The two sides don't understand each other, the essay claimed, and worse, they don't even respect each other. Their conflict has disastrous consequences for the whole world. Part of the instant appeal of Snow's thesis stemmed from the fact that he himself was firmly entrenched in both of the warring cultures. He was at the same time a competent physicist and an accomplished novelist. He was his own most flagrant counterexample. Nevertheless, as recently as 2008, the Times Literary Supplement included his book in a list of the 100 most influential works since World War II. Snow's complaint, which grew out of his experiences in Britain's university system, was that the dominant humanistic culture looked down upon the scientific culture and thereby impeded its progress. In his view, this attitude prevented the country's leaders from understanding and harnessing the immense power of science and technology, and thus contributed to a much deeper, wider, and more serious global rift, the gulf between the rich and the poor. But Snow was an optimist. He thought that the chasm between the two cultures can be bridged, and indeed that it will be bridged. And therefore, speaking of income inequality, he confidently predicted that by the year 2000, the disparity between the rich and the poor would be erased. How tragically wrong he turned out to be. Snow's first prediction, that the two cultures would eventually merge, proved to be accurate. Modern technology, and I think particularly information technology, is powerful enough to blur the distinction between science and the humanities, but beyond recognition. Today, artists of all stripes are proficient in the latest computer technology. Even my wife Barbara, who's an art historian, and our daughter Lily, a painter and sculptor, teach me how to run my own computer. At the same time, the science section of the newspaper holds its own with the traditional sections on music, art, and literature. And penguins run across the screen of millions of television sets in science and nature programs. Science is no longer treated with contempt, not even in Britain. But even though scientists and humanists have grown closer to each other than was conceivable 50 years ago, the rich continue to get richer and the poor poorer. C.P. Snow's division of the world, as persuasive as it once seemed, is no longer useful. But before I replace it with a different classification, I must acknowledge his warning of the perils of inventing dichotomies. The number two is a very dangerous number, he intoned. Attempts at dividing anything in two ought to be regarded with much suspicion. Indeed, blaming the ills of the world on the conflict between science and humanities, or between science and religion, or between liberals and conservatives, rarely gets to the root of the problem. Beware of the number two, lest it polarize and lest you oversimplify. Undeterred by this excellent advice from my fellow physicist and writer, I will rashly propose a different division of the world into two distinct populations. I am confident that your legendary UU skepticism will lead you to regard my proposal with much suspicion. My suggestion is an attempt to dig deeper than C.P. Snow. I wonder whether there are perhaps conflicts in human nature itself, conflicts that are more profound than the purely academic divide between science and the humanities. I think that I have identified one such conflict. I believe that the world is divided into two camps. In one camp, there are those who can comfortably live with ambiguity. In the other are the people who require certainty. The former accept ambiguity, understand uncertainty, and cope with complexity. They know that the world is permanently obscured by a fog of confusion and muddled by doubt. In contrast, those in the other camp need the anchors of absolute truth, of crystal clarity, of reliable principles on which to base their actions and decisions. I realize that, of course, there is a bit of both attitudes in each of us, but the distinction is real and profound. And it is for that reason that I was happy to see the yin and the yang on the front of your program, because that symbolizes exactly what I'm talking about. My categories, you will notice, cut right across those of Baron Snow. Scientists cope with uncertainty as a matter of necessity, but artists not only cope, but they positively celebrate. They wallow in ambiguity. Poetry, painting, even music put ambiguity to work in order to enrich their messages. Similarly, the opposite attitude, the quest for certainty, is as deeply embedded in science as it is in poetry. So let's cast aside Snow's two cultures and turn instead to a new duality, the conflict between a worldview built on the quicksand of ambiguity and one that seeks firm foundations in absolutes. My own first encounter with the yearning for absolutes came about in a very direct, in-your-face kind of way. The family of David, my best friend in high school, belonged to a radical Christian movement called Moral Rearmament. David wanted to convert me to it, and I was willing to hear him out. So he took me one summer to the movement's world headquarters on Mackinac Island, Michigan, in Lake Huron, a spectacular sight indeed. There, in their own camp and in the meeting rooms of the historic Grand Hotel, I spent a week learning the principles of moral rearmament. The philosophy of the group is based on four absolutes. And you must always, when I mention them, imagine them spelled in capital letters. They are absolute honesty, absolute unselfishness, absolute purity, and absolute love. Now, with my logical German mind, I just couldn't grasp these. I remember sitting with David on a sloping green lawn overlooking the vast Great Lakes sparkling in the sun and arguing earnestly about theology. 60 years later, I still recall what I thought was my best shot. How can unselfishness be absolute, I asked. Since I am moderately unselfish, I try to help others in need. But if I were to be absolutely unselfish, I would give away my clothes and run around naked. I would distribute my food and starve. I would donate every penny I own and live in the streets. Of course, David tried to weasel out of my too literal interpretation, but he couldn't convince me. I certainly welcomed the call for unselfishness, but balked at the idea of absolute unselfishness, and the same with the other three pillars of moral rearmament. In the end, I returned home unconverted. The four absolutes were just too demanding for me. In my subsequent education and career as a physicist, I learned that nothing in science is absolute. Consider the size of this lectern. If I tell you that it is 32 inches wide, you know that I don't mean exactly 32 inches down to a million decimal places, but something much more approximate. And the same holds for theories. Newton's laws of motion, which once reigned supreme as the ultimate example of an absolute fact, is only approximately true. For very heavy objects like stars and very high speeds like that of light and very tiny particles like atoms, it fails miserably. So how can you tell where and when Newton is supposed to be right? Dealing with such uncertainties complicates physics. One of my perennial problems as a teacher has been to help students maneuver in this foggy world of ambiguity, to draw reasonable conclusions and reliable guides for future action from uncertain facts and fickle theories. Look at what catastrophic problems the failure to tolerate ambiguity has caused for the world. Today, as we celebrate the 43rd annual Earth Day, we are bombarded from all sides by the opinions of those who can't stand uncertainty. When scientists predict that the climate is likely to change, they are accused of spreading panic without having absolute proof. When they speak of the probability of global warming, the opposition fixates on the word probability and demands certainty instead. The tactic is not new. Recall the demands of the cigarette industry for proof of the link between nicotine and cancer, the interminable battle over the definition of the moment at which life begins, and the perennial silly claim that gaps in the fossil record invalidate the theory of evolution. The astute philosopher Voltaire recognized that perfect is the enemy of good. He meant that perfectionism undermines the benefits and the satisfaction that come from mere competence. Perfectionists insist that if a job is not flawlessly executed, it is a failure. In exactly the same way, the demand for absolute certainty is the enemy of action based on reasonable expectations. Nowhere is the conflict between the two opposing worldviews more pronounced than in the sphere of religion. I think that the great seductive power of conventional religion rests on the desire for certainty, for absolutes, for unambiguous answers. The world is complicated and messy and incomprehensible, so it is comforting to be able to rely on a few certain truths to cling to. But what if others believe in a different set of absolute truths? Why, then they must be wrong or misguided or just plain bad. Isn't that the basis for innumerable bloody wars throughout history? Doesn't that unforgiving principle lie at the root of the current nasty battles between the true believers and the angry atheists, between Shiites and Sunnis, between Christians and Muslims, between Jews and Palestinians? Living with ambiguity actually transcends mere tolerance for other beliefs. A true Christian, in the best sense, for example, believes in certain dogmas but respects the right of others to hold different beliefs. Indeed, religious tolerance is a virtue of many deeply religious people. But true believers still cling to the conviction that in the end they are right and the others are wrong. They say, "I generously allow you to persist in your erroneous ways." Only those who are perfectly comfortable living with ambiguity know that the world is big enough to accommodate many contradictory beliefs at the same time. The need for certainties, for absolutes, for absolute truths runs deep in the human soul. Even many scientists who, as I said, deal with ambiguity as a matter of course, feel that need. They know fully well that they will never know all the details of the universe, but many hope that we will be able to discover the ultimate absolute true laws that govern it. Stephen Hawking, for example, ended his famous book, A Brief History of Time, by hoping that physicists will someday have a complete theory of the material universe. Then, he concluded, we should know the mind of God. Well, I, for one, am happy to live with ambiguity. I don't believe that even if the mind of God were to exist, we would ever be capable of knowing it. In fact, I don't even want to know everything, especially not the future. I believe that the universe is evolving in an unpredictable, ever-surprising way, and that through my exercise of free will, I can influence its future in tiny ways. It doesn't pre-exist, not even in the mind of God. I help to create it in my own humble way, every day, in every little action I take. So in the end, how can I reconcile the fact that the world is ambiguous and unpredictable with my human need for fixed truths that serve as anchor posts in this confusing world of ours? For me, the answer to that vexing question comes again from physics. The great Danish physicist Niels Bohr, who was considered to be Einstein's only peer, cast physics and philosophy in terms of trade-offs, of contradictory statements, which he called complementary. Bohr learned about complementary quantities from the quantum theory he himself helped to create. It turns out that if you know where an atom is, you don't know how fast it's traveling. Conversely, if you measure its speed, you don't know exactly where it is. This profound insight and this realization that this is really the way the world is upset everything we thought we had learned from Newton and his followers. Bohr applied the lesson of complementarity way beyond physics to philosophy and even to everyday life. The idea is actually very simple. We encounter it every day. Eating your cake and having it, for example, are complementary notions. You can't have both. Each comes at the expense of the other. It's your choice to pick one over the other or just to do a little bit of both. Bohr's favorite pair of complementary notions was the dichotomy truth and clarity. In German, they happen to rhyme, which makes them easier to remember. Truth and clarity are Wahrheit and Klarheit. In spite of C.P. Snow's warning against the number two, I find that the pair truth and clarity sums up in a nutshell my attitude toward both science and religion, and perhaps toward my whole world. Consider my old problem with unselfishness. The simple, clear demand for absolute unselfishness is untenable and therefore untrue. No one who claims to uphold that absolute can possibly be telling the truth. But unselfishness as a complex, muddled, ambiguous idea, an idea that is often difficult to exercise in practice, that's something I firmly believe in. Unselfishness is a virtue, that is true, and part of our own WUU mission statement. For me, complementarity blunts the sharp, forbidding edges of absolute truth and helps me to navigate in an uncertain world. If you ask me to accept God as an absolute truth, I can only do that if you allow me to define God in unclear, intuitive, and utterly ambiguous terms. But if you paint God in clear terms as an omniscient, omnipotent, and omnipresent creature, or else as a kind of bearded gentleman up in heaven, then I think you are wrong. As Robert Graves put it, he continues quick and dull in his clear images. I continue slow and sharp in my broken images. So in the end, I have built my own theology, as I am encouraged to do by the UU Code of Conduct, on the cheerful acceptance of ambiguity and uncertainty. But if, like most people, I feel the need to set down some principles as true, or at least true for me, then I'm prepared to admit that I cannot state them very clearly. Amen. So be it.